The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum of Accelerated Government Strategies, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum from Accelerated Government Strategies, providing advisory consulting for innovative startups to help grow government revenue. Every week, Aileen and Gigi welcome Washington, D.C.'s most ambitious and influential female executives who are taking risks to engineer success and shape the future. Women of Washington on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now your hosts, Aileen Black and Gigi Shum.
I'm Aileen Black.
And I'm Gigi Shum.
Today, our guest is Beth Killoran, Chief Information Officer of the Department of Health and Human Services. Beth previously was the Deputy CIO and Executive Director of HHS's Office of IT Strategy, Policy, and Governance since she joined the department in October of 2014. Prior to her time at HHS, Beth had an 11-year career at the Department of Homeland Security. Beth has a BA in psychology and a master's of technology management from the University of Maryland. Beth, thank you for taking the time today to join us.
It's my pleasure.
Beth, let's begin with your background. Virtually all successful women had a big influence growing up. Who was yours?
Realistically, I had a number of individuals that influenced me as I moved forward, primarily around technology. When I was in high school and into college, technology was just starting. It was very interesting when I was in high school. Technology and IT was very easy to me. My parents told me that that was what I needed to pursue as I moved into college. I told them no because it was too easy. I wanted something more challenging, so I went into personnel psychology. But then, of course, reverted to IT after I get out. But obviously, folks that were very innovative in technology, whether that was, Bill Gates or others in the technology field at the time, were very influential because I thought that there was a lot of new technology and things that could help the American public. And that was a very large influence on me going into this field and moving forward today.
Wow. Normally, our guests talk about how they were kind of, steered away from technology. You and I are about the same age. And back then, maybe pushed towards what you decided to do. What made you find, open the apertures that you thought technology was easy and that it was something that you had a natural tendency to be good at?
So when I was in high school, we had the first kind of programs and programming in the schools, using computers. And each one of those challenges that were presented while I was in high school, easily conquered them, had straight A's and all of those kind of capabilities. I was very math and science focused. All of my advanced placement classes that I took except for English in high school are all math and science. So my natural ability and desire was in the math and science arena and involving in that into the technology at the same time.
So, but as you mentioned, Beth, you went and you got your undergraduate degree in psychology. And so what were your early career aspirations? Were you ever planning on doing anything with psychology?
Yes. So when I got out of college, my desire was to actually go work for OPM. I thought that as an industrial and personal psych major, OPM sounded like a great fit for me. When I got out in the early 90s, it was kind of the first time that the federal government was actually shrinking in size. And it was very difficult to hire off of the street at that time. I had actually done a couple of summer internships with the Department of the Navy. And when I got out of college, the opportunity presented itself to go to the Department of Navy as a contractor, working on ergonomics to help placement of technology, of how far the keyboard should be, what type of seating you should have, where the monitor should be placed. And so it took a little bit of technology, but also the industrial psychology. So I moved into that field.
Today, we're talking with Beth Killoran, CIO of HHS.
So, Beth, you decided to come to Washington to join the government or to work for the government. Were you from Washington?
So, when I was born, I was actually born in Michigan. My parents moved around a lot as I was a child. They were not in the military, but my father was actually in the soda industry, so worked for Pepsi in a number of different places. So, we actually lived in West Virginia and then in Mississippi, and eventually came to the D.C. area when I was a sophomore in high school. And after high school, I moved on to the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and did my undergraduate degree there. I actually stayed in the area for my first couple of jobs and actually joined the government. I actually had to move out of the district or the area. I actually moved to Houston, Texas, to take my first federal job.
So what was your first federal job there in Houston, Texas?
So I was actually hired as a land administrator for the U.S. Customs Service, which was under the Department of Treasury at the time. My job was to provide land administration support to all of the facilities within Houston, down to Galveston, and all the way over to Oklahoma and Oklahoma City, and provide support to the personnel and systems in that geographic area.
So if you were a young woman starting out right now, having the same aspirations of you, would you recommend somebody to join the government, and why?
I think that a government is a great place to work. I think that when I talk to a lot of the millennials today, they really do want to come into the public sector because they actually have been doing a lot of support for volunteerism, seeing their dedication to the American public overall, and they see coming into the government actually fulfills that need that they have and being able to provide back. I think that the government serves as a good place to mature. It has a lot of different opportunities, and there's so many different missions and so much geographic distance between locations that people can not only learn different kind of capabilities, you have the opportunity to move around, and if one thing doesn't fit, you can try again. I've been in 3 federal agencies now, learning lots of different missions, so no matter what kind of individual kind of mission you are passionate about, you can find that somewhere in the government.
So, Beth, you mentioned that you were at Treasury at Customs and that you were responsible for providing IT operational support during both 9/11, but also during the Oklahoma City bombing. And you just told the story about how you were in Houston. You had responsibility for land support for Oklahoma City. So what was the role of IT during those really critical events?
Yeah, so I will say that those 2 individual events and my role in supporting providing IT operations to the U.S. Customs Service at the time really established my desire and need to make sure that we're providing great customer service. When I was in Houston, as you mentioned, I was there during the Oklahoma City bombing. I was actually in Oklahoma City the day before the bombing and actually providing support to those areas and those facilities. I actually got calls the next day, you know, frantically, are you still in Oklahoma? I said, no, what are you talking about? And they mentioned that the bombing had happened. I actually went back to Oklahoma City 3 days after the bombing. And I actually got to meet some of the individuals that had been in the building during the bombing. We were responsible for quickly setting up new IT capabilities for those workers and employees at the airport, so they could as quickly as possible get back to a normal way of life. You know, the individuals that I met were actually physically shaking. You could still see the anxiety and the stress on them, but they were just so appreciative to have something to come back to because they didn't want to sit in their houses anymore. They wanted to get back with their coworkers. They wanted to get back to the job to have some level of normalcy. When I was in the Oklahoma City, after that, I came back to D.C., and 9/11, I was actually responsible for IT operations nationwide. And I actually had staff in the Trade Center. We were in World Trade 6. So actually, we had the towers fall onto our building. And we were responsible in that case, again, to relocate the personnel from World Trade 6 out to the airport to, again, make sure that they had some level of normalcy. We actually had to fly Blackhawks in with equipment because no planes were flying yet. And we got a special arrangements to load over 200 desktops and laptops via Blackhawk out to the airport and as quickly as possible get the facility stood up for these additional personnel and find space, again, just to get them some level of normalcy. Actually, during 9/11, I was actually on vacation. I was actually out west, and I got a call from my boss that they, you know, everybody had to get called back in. They really needed help. Me and my now husband drove 36 hours straight across the country because we were out at the Grand Canyon, straight across from Friday through Saturday night. And I arrived in D.C. just in time to go to work Monday morning at 9 o'clock and make sure that we got everything we needed to do for those employees.
Wow, it's just amazing, and you know, so close to just a couple of days after, you know, 9/11. It's I have several questions, but what was it like? What did it feel like when you literally had seen the building in Oklahoma City one day, and then half a week later you were back there and it was gone?
It's really a surreal feeling. I mean, I didn't actually go up for 9/11. We actually had people do that, but when you're there and you're in the room and you see the part of the building that you support, it's either exposed or no longer existent. And you're driving by and seeing the pictures and the signs and the memos and different notes that people have left behind. It's very surreal when you see it on television. It's more so when you've been in the place. You see you actually get to talk to the individuals that are directly impacted. You know what was happening in that building 3 or 4 days earlier, and now you know what the consequence of one individual or one organization has, not only on one person, but a community and a business overall. And what I thought was very compelling about it is for the people that were at the airport that weren't directly impacted, of how they wanted to help the organization and their co-workers get back to that level of normalcy, and what they were going to do, whatever they needed to do in order to provide what those individuals needed, whether that's to come back to work, let them have, you know, extended leave, whatever it was. Everybody was ready to chip in and do what they needed to do. No one asked, you know, should we be here after hours? No one was, I don't want to be called up. Everybody's, what can I do to help? All of us feeling a level of frustration and helplessness that we couldn't do more. But anything that we could do to try to provide them some level of normalcy or support is what we wanted to do.
And what lessons have you taken from those events and those experiences, either life lessons or lessons that you've taken through the rest of your career?
So the biggest one for me has always been is that the customer comes first. I see a lot of the government, it's mine, I want a bigger piece of the pie, it's all about my perspective in taking control. That's not what the government's about. We are here to serve the American people, we are here to serve the employees, and IT is an enabler. And so everything place I've gone is I tell people, we wouldn't have a job if it wasn't for the employees that we support and the mission they need to do, or the American public overall. And that always comes back to those two events. Because if you don't understand why you're here, why do it?
We're speaking with Beth Killeran, CIO of HHS. Coming up, we'll ask Beth about her role at HHS. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today, we're talking with Beth Killeran, CIO of HHS.
So, Beth, in the announcement of your new role that was sent out by the Deputy Secretary, what was clear in that was that cybersecurity is a main focus of what you are going to be working on, and in fact, why you were chosen for that role. Of the four big initiatives, CyberCare, the Phishing Campaign Program, Healthy Technology, and Workforce Development Program that are kind of the platforms, three of those are cyber-related. When I read that, that seemed to me to be a pretty marked change from Frank Bateman, the prior CIO's initiatives, where he was more focused on data center consolidation and moving applications to the cloud. So what is driving the new and increased focus on cyber?
The reason for the shift is as the threats have evolved, we need to make sure that we are addressing them. When the Department of Homeland Security stood up, they have an organization called the National Preparedness and Programs Directorate, and they are responsible for protecting each of our key sectors within the United States, whether it's the energy sector, the financial sector, healthcare sector, and so on. When they first stood up, they understood that the most critical sectors of a threat perspective were definitely the energy sector and the financial sector. But as time has evolved, you know, it's much easier to, you know, change information around a credit card. Even Social Security numbers on the black market are not going or aren't as valuable as they once were. The shift has gone to healthcare. Your information around you and what you have around your health is something that stays with you no matter what. And that particular information is very critical to a lot of organizations that would like to do us harm, whether they're state actors, whether they're private entities that are trying to get money from individuals. And as that threat has evolved, our agency has been, it's very critical for us not only to protect the data that we have about our employees, but more critically about the data of the American public that provides data for us for our programs that they need to use and the ways that they're interacting with us. So actually, each of those four has cyber in them, because even in our IT workforce, our most critical IT workforce right now is cyber.
So, Beth, you've been officially in your job for 60 days. I know you were acting for quite a long time before that. But tell me, what was your biggest surprise coming to HHS?
So it was very interesting. As I moved from the Department of Homeland Security over to Health and Human Services, I think the biggest surprise for me was is how collegial the organizational is. I think it's because of the nature of Health and Human Services being there to support the American public. That is actually ingrained in all of the individuals. Most of the people in the organization have worked in Health and Human Services for a number of years because of the passion they have around the mission. And I think that was a nice and refreshing change. Not that the Department of Homeland Security doesn't have a wonderful mission, but their mission is kind of to keep the bad guys out. And that kind of permeates throughout the employees, because that's a different kind of culture. And at Health and Human Services, we're here to provide those services to the American public. And that kind of thought process is also in the culture. And that was actually probably the most positive and pleasant surprise I had.
Now, does that kind of make it more difficult to implement these very critical cyber initiatives that really is about stopping the bad guy, which, you know, there's two different sides of you know, the personality here. Mm-hmm. You have one that's the care and feeding and support, which is the wonderful thing that HHS does. But the fact of the matter is there's some bad guys out there that want to get our information and do not good things with it.
Yeah. So there was at the beginning part of when we start talking about cybersecurity, I think there was a little bit of that within the department, because it's like, well, I've got to get my mission done. These are critical services. You know, I need to provide insurance. I need to make sure that I'm getting that the food and drugs that we take are safe, that we are, you know, investing in new innovative ways to care for our individuals, providing services and investing in new technologies around those. But when we started talking to all of our operating divisions, whether that's for the Centers for Disease Control, National Institutes of Health, or so on, what we talked to them about is, yes, those are all very critical missions, but you have to take a risk mitigation approach. If you can't provide those, what's the impact? And if a cyber incident happens, you will not be able to provide that mission. So do you really want to take the risk of doing nothing, and what the impact's going to be if you're prevented by an incident happening? And as we started having those conversations, not just with the technologists, our acting deputy secretary has been very strong, and even our secretary, about we've got to do a risk management approach. And as we started talking to the business leaders about that, some light bulbs started going off, and we had having business conversations. Those business conversations led to, we need to make sure that we are balancing doing the business with what is going to prevent us from doing the business. And we actually have incorporated an enterprise risk management framework, our chief financial officer has. And across the organization, as we looked at it, cyber and the threat to cyber on our mission has become our number one risk. And with that, that has changed the priority, and it's changed the dialogue, and incurred that we were able to have the right conversations and engage the right folks.
So, Beth, in May, you had the pleasure, I'll use that term loosely, of testifying up on the Hill in front of the House Oversight Committee, along with Tony Scott and a couple of the other department CIOs. And a focus of that whole session was on the modernization, or the lack thereof, of government IT systems. And according to GAO, although the federal IT budget has risen to $90 billion, spending on new systems or modernization has declined by $7 billion since 2010. So depending on which agency, as much as 75% or more of your IT budget is going to maintaining older, sometimes obsolete systems. So how are you, as the CIO of HHS, how are you dealing with that problem?
So that's a great question. With the passage of the Federal IT Acquisition Reform Act, or FITARA, one of the things that our agency has done is making sure that we're putting in a robust framework where we're able to have visibility of our IT dollars at the departmental level, reviewing those IT dollars at a more detailed level, and understanding how each of our operating divisions are utilizing their IT dollars. For me, I look at legacy as not necessarily a bad thing. There are certain things that are legacy that are still provided support by vendors. We still have, you know, individuals within organizations that know that technology and can provide that support pretty regularly, and we are actually able to maintain it. Just because something is 20 years old doesn't mean it's bad. Where I get concerned is when we truly have end of life types of technology, and end of life to me means that you can't upgrade it, you can't secure it, you can't get support for it. And those are the things that I'm making sure as we're having these budgetary conversations, what are those systems within each of our organizations and what are the paths forward that our organizations have to remove those, and making sure that until we can remove them or update them, how are you making sure that they're staying secure? You know, is there anything that we can either reduce access? Can we put it farther into behind firewalls? What can we do to make sure that while that system may be mission critical, that we're protecting it and making sure that we're giving the care and feeding it needs?
So, Beth, you are a growing number of women CIOs in the federal government. Laverne Council, Dawn Leaf, Sylvia Burns. And HHS has one of the largest IT budgets in the civilian agencies. Actually, if you add those up, it's like a huge amount of money that you ladies are focusing in on. Now, that's quite an accomplishment because there are not very many women in these level positions in private industry. I think Fortune magazine states that, you know, about 4 to 6% of the C-suite jobs are held by women. So go. This is very exciting. But I got to ask you, so, you know, what can your counterparts in the commercial world learn that the government's doing right, that the percentages for women in the C-suite are starting to look a little bit more like the population for the government versus the very out of whack percentages that are on the commercial side?
So one of the things that I would recommend is that within the federal government, I have never or almost never felt that my gender had anything to do with my capability. For almost the majority of my career, I was looked at based on what I could provide, my dedication to the mission, my dedication to getting things done, to being responsive to the management chain, making sure that we're meeting those missions. And I think if you, whether you're in the public or the private sector, if you look at an individual based on their capability, their dedication to an organization, and the drive to make that organization better, it shouldn't matter whether they're male or female, whether they're, you know, any particular race. It should be based on capability and the dedication to that organization, the drive to get it done versus what package it comes in.
We're speaking with Beth Killeran, CIO of HHS. Coming up, we'll ask Beth about mentors in her career. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today, we're talking with Beth Killeran, CIO, HHS.
So, Beth, we always talk about mentorship quite a bit on this show. So let me ask you a question. Have you had important mentors in your career?
So what's interesting with my career is I've had mentors at different points in time. I actually told her I was going to do this, so she won't be surprised. But I think overall, over the last 11 years, one of my biggest mentors has actually been Margie Graves, which is very interesting because Margie and I started at the Department of Homeland Security at the same time. She actually came into TSA, the Transportation Security Administration, at the same time I was going to Customs and Border Protection. Coming from different paths, she came from outside, I came from inside. But right when the department stood up, she was actually asked to come over to the department or to help with doing some infrastructure integration, getting 22 agencies down to one. I was actually put onto that program. So Margie was there from the beginning. She's still there. And actually, you know, now over at the federal level, and that's where I just saw her a couple of minutes ago. But even when I was contemplating going to HHS, she was the person that I called and said, you know, this is kind of the opportunity. What do you think? Calling her on different times of even like with the CIO position, what did she think about that? So she's been a very good sounding board for me. You know, she's actually done different things. She's seen many different things. She's had been from both the inside and outside, but she's a very respected person within the federal sector. And our careers have kind of been in parallel. We've been either in offices together throughout those 11 years that we were there or relying on each other in some way. So I really have relied on Margie in many ways.
You know, it's a great story, and it brings up a question to me. I think that in general, when you talk to men about mentors, they typically are thinking of kind of the concept of, you know, kind of that godfather, the older person in an organization that may act as a mentor, may also act as a sponsor to help them rise through an organization. We ask the question all the time on this show, and many times women answer it similarly to you, in that a mentor is, in essence, can be a peer. We've even had people say they've been mentored by people who work for them. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just struck by the fact that there appears to be a broader definition of the term that women use when we talk about mentoring.
Yeah, I mean, and I will say that, you know, for me, I actually have different individuals I would call, especially when I'm going out to different kind of speaking engagements, because being someone that tends to be the one that doesn't talk in the room, you know, I'm always trying to find out from a couple of key cohorts that I have of, okay, how would it be best to engage this? Because what I don't want to come out is, well, she's the person that's too good for all of us standing in the corner, when it's just sometimes difficult for me to engage in the small talk. So, you know, even just mentoring in those types of arenas, I've never had mentoring of how do I get to the top. My path of getting here has probably been very abnormal. I don't know if there probably is a normal one, but I never had a process of I need someone to figure out my career because I want to get to the top. Mine is more, you know, these are the circumstances and the situation are here. Here's kind of the things that I'm thinking about. Could you give me your advice? And moving forward from that situation, balancing, it's always good to have a sounding board in those circumstances.
So, Beth, let me turn this question around. Have you had a chance to mentor?
Yeah, so I mean, there are different individuals. I mean, I try to do that with folks in my office and people that I've had working through for me and with me throughout the career that are at different points in their career path. And they're, you know, contemplating whether they should move into management, whether they should, you know, be changing agencies, whether they should leave the government and go to the private sector, whether they should move into an SES role. And what I usually coach them about is, first of all, you need to look at your work-life balance. I'm very concerned, and that was one of the things I was thinking about as I went into the S of a work-life balance. You also have to understand what your priorities are within your life. Is work your priority? Is family your priority? Understand what those things are. I always tell folks, you know, you need to look at pluses and minuses, because there's pluses and minuses of any job or any career that you have. But also to try to find your passion. If you can work and do something that you're excited about doing every day, then that's where you need to be. Even if it, you know, doesn't have a fancy dollar sign or it doesn't have a fancy title in front of it, if it's something that you're happy doing, then that's the job for you. I've been very successful or fortunate over the last 10 years of my career that every job that I've been to has been something I was very passionate about and very excited to do. And if it's something that's not, there's a great big world out there, and you just need to look internally to figure out what that is and then go seek it for yourself.
Now, we have a change in administration coming up, and you kind of loosely mentioned earlier that when you became the CIO of HHS, you had to go sit in front of Congress to get approved. So what mentoring advice would you have for some of the incoming, you know, political appointees for going through that process? Maybe you could tell us a little bit how, I'll say it's a grueling process, so I'll just introduce it that way, and what advice you'd have for somebody going through that.
So, I mean, one of the big things I tell anyone when they're doing anything or preparing is first listen and learn. And then prepare. anyone that's coming in new to an agency, whether they're going to the Hill or coming into a new agency to run it, the first thing it's really critical to understand is what's happening in the organization now. Some leaders will do that and take, you know, that 30, 60, 90 day learning about the organization, interviewing, finding out what's working well, what isn't. And then you have some that just come in and I'm going to change it because I want to change things wholeheartedly. That becomes very disruptive in an organization. There becomes a cultural change, and you tend to sometimes lose a lot of your great talented people because this is their day-to-day job and they've been there for X amount of years, days. And that stress of unknowing or what's going to happen to them makes them want to move on to something else where they have a little bit more control or understanding. So the first thing is to listen. The next thing would be to, after you do that, to learn. What do you know about this organization? Find out. Read the policies. Read the regulations. Talk to people both internally and externally that have experience in those organizations. And then plan. Based on what you've heard and learned, what things do you want to do to make sure that your administration accomplishes its objectives? What partnerships and things do you, relationships need to build? And then move that into action.
Today we're talking with Beth Killeran, CIO of HHS. So Beth, you've worked your entire year with the federal government. And it's important, maybe more important now than ever, that the government be able to recruit the best and brightest graduates coming out of colleges. So how do you think that the government can compete with the private sector to recruit, especially millennials who are now coming into the workforce? I mean, you don't have the stock options. Sometimes you don't have the same salaries. You don't have the perks, the pool tables and ping pong tables and whatever they may have out in places like Silicon Valley. I mean, for technology jobs, it's tough, isn't it?
Yes, in some ways it is. But one of the things that we have that a lot of those don't are the mission. And so one of the things that we really have been able to market is the really diverse mission. You know, there aren't too many places that where you can say that we cracked the genome. There aren't too many places you can say, well, we cured Ebola. There aren't too many places to say we're building vaccines for Zika. So if you talk about the mission and what that actual impact is to the American public, that becomes a very large draw, especially for millennials. As I mentioned, a lot of them really want to help. They are very civic oriented, but we have to balance that with being able to recruit them and get them on board quickly. One of the things that, you know, I've been talking about in other places is how do we improve that process? We are working internally with HHS within our HR organization. They're trying to work with the Office of Personnel Management across the board of how do we be able to recruit more easily? Because I think one of the things we're doing is we're losing, because if it takes us 6 months and the private sector can take 2 weeks, you know, a lot of these folks need those jobs and they just can't wait the 6 months. The other part of that is when a lot of the millennials that we have don't want to do the same thing. And so these are not, you know, the baby boomers that are happy doing the same job for 30 years. So we're trying to also build in rotations or job swapping and different kinds of things. So they, every year or 6 months, that they want to try different things or learn different skills, they have those opportunities and they can see that they have flexibility within the organization without having to leave and go to the private sector. What we've seen recently is we have the ability to recruit, but it's then retaining, because they'll recruit, they'll get the skills, and then they'll get taken away by the private sector. And we won't get them back until they're very civic oriented towards the end of their career. And so it's that middle piece we're trying to strive for.
We're speaking with Beth Killeran, CIO of HHS. Coming up, we'll find out what advice Beth has for somebody else who wants to join the government. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking with Beth Killeran, CIO of HHS. Now, Beth, I got to tell you, your passion is inspirational for the mission. So if you were to talk to somebody who wanted to follow in your footsteps and become a CIO of, you know, with this great mission like Department of HHS, what advice would you have? What should they study? How should they get started?
Well, what's very interesting is I would always tell people, they're always like, well, how do I get to where you are? And I will tell you, I don't know how I got to where I was. This was not my career aspiration. I had individual goals along the way. But about, 8 or 9 years ago, I'd filled my career path. I expected to be at a GS-15 level doing certain kinds of work. And at that point, I'm like, okay, well, now what? I've got, you know, another 20 years to go in the federal government. It's time to do something different. But what I will say to people that want to either be a CIO or they want to be a president or whatever it is, realize that the path that you think may not necessarily be the path in front of you. One of the things that I have learned over my last four jobs, and I always tell people this, so the last four positions I had, I applied for one job. I started that job, and in less than a year, that was not my job. And so you have to be flexible. You have to understand that whatever job is given to you, be the best at that job you can. People are watching. People understand when you're being successful. They understand when you're stepping it up, when they have gaps that are critical and need to be filled, whether you're being responsive to that, whether you're excelling at that, or you're just begrudgingly doing it. People are always observing and watching. And in the federal government, especially in D.C., it's a very small community. And so somebody that you might cross today, you're going to cross paths with again. And so try not to make enemies. Always make sure you're being collaborative and always put your best foot forward in whatever opportunity happens, because what you think might be a drudging job today ends up being the best opportunity for you then or at some point in the future.
So, you know, I have four kids. Gigi has four kids. And, you know, when they, and mine are a little bit younger, they're just going through college. But, you know, they feel like they should have their whole career mapped out. I mean, this generation is pretty tense, or at least my kids are, about, you know, what advice would you have for somebody like that? Because, you know, everybody's career, including mine, you know, took some really good turns and change is good. So,
yeah, well, I mean, and so I'm one of those folks that embraces change. And so don't be so concerned about what 10 years looks like. Look at 1 year or 2 years. You know, as I mentioned, I started out at the Department of Defense, but as a contractor for the Navy, thinking I was going to do ergonomics. Well, within 6 months, they said, well, we don't have any money now to do ergonomics. We need to do IT training. And that, you know, turned into, you know, IT training and learning about software and then supporting it. So as you learn, you might think you have a passion about something, but as you have different opportunities in front of you, your different passions will find themselves. And something you thought, well, God, I'm going to love this, you're going to hate. Don't be in a job that you're hating just because you decided this was the way you were going to go. Open yourself up to new opportunities. Always learn and always make sure that you're opening that aperture to new experiences. And at the end of the day, the path that's supposed to happen for you is going to happen.
So I'm going to tag team that question, Beth, right? You are a self-described introvert. And you just said when you were talking about your career that you weren't quite sure how you got to where you are and that you sort of saw yourself doing these technical things. Well, now you're not doing technical things. You're leading a very large organization. And so with that comes testifying in front of Congress, public speaking. You can't meet all of your employees. You have to communicate, you know, via video and on stage. How does an introvert, how have you incorporated or changed your leadership style given what your natural tendencies are?
Yeah, so I mean, what I try to do is I do much better one-on-one with individuals or small groups. And what's interesting is when I'm in a large auditorium or in large areas, it's easier for me to talk to one or two individuals in the crowd, and then it becomes a much smaller, close conversation. The other thing is I make sure that I know ahead of time what I want my messages to be. And that way, but I don't have scripts. When I try to get into a script, I become so paranoid that I have to read the script that it becomes very stilted. So I try to make sure I know what my key ideas are, what my key themes are, and make sure that I try to make personal connections with stories or examples that they can relate to. And then trying to find different ways, again, to bring folks into that smaller group. I try to do, you know, individual thank yous. I try to personalize some of the experiences. So even at my first all hands, we didn't just talk about the technology. We celebrated people's weddings. We celebrated their first children, things that make their job their work family, because you're spending a lot of time in your job. And so one of the things I'm trying to do is I'm very happy and passionate about my family, and I really like my work-life balance. So I want to make sure that we're making the work internally another part of their family.
So, Beth, you brought up work-life balance, and you have passion clearly at work and for your family at home. Now, what is your strategies? You know, I hate the term you can have it all, because like you said, you have to make some choices. So what is your strategy, and how do you make those choices to make it work for you?
So one of the best things is to have a great partner. So my husband is phenomenal. We take turns. We have a 9-year-old son. And so obviously we want to make sure that he is front and foremost the most important thing to us. I do feel sometimes guilty that I can't go to every school play or go to every occurrence at the school, but we make sure that at least on a quarterly basis, one of us goes to one of those events for him so that he has his parents present. I always have the morning duty, so I make sure that I take him to school. I get him up every morning. We have some, you know, just son mommy time in the morning, and then my husband picks him up in the afternoon. My son is a major fanatic of the Washington Nationals, so we actually have, you know, partial season tickets, and we always make sure that we're going to all those games as a family. Make sure that, you know, I've got my work things arranged ahead of time that, you know, and if the crisis comes, my husband knows that, you know, I have no off button, and he's there to fill in those gaps. And then, you know, my son's playing games all the time. So yesterday I just make sure on my calendar there's certain names I must leave on time. And I left right on time yesterday to make sure that I was right there when he did his first hit of the baseball. And you make sure you just work both of those things into your schedule. And there are days that, my family knows that, you know, mommy's going to be not home until 7 o'clock. You know, and those are the days that they get a crock pot dinner. And then the other days that, you know, we make sure that I'm home by, you know, 5:30, and we have dinner together as a family. We'll go walk the dogs and make sure that we have a balance of time that we do things together.
So, Beth, I got to ask you, we've talked about mentoring, but if you were to go back in time and to meet Beth as she was graduating for her undergraduate degree, tell me, what advice would you give her that would help her achieve the success that you've had for your career?
I would basically tell her that, you know, you're going to have a lot of different experiences throughout your career. You're going to have some that, you know, you're going to see successes far beyond you could ever try to achieve or think about. You're also going to have some pretty significant roadblocks. You know, you're going to have to take both the successes and the challenges as they come. Try not to overthink them until they're there, but take each one of them and realize that the road is not a straight path, that there's turns, there's twists. Some of it are going to even come back on each other, but experience each one of those. Try to make sure that you're using the experience you have now, apply it as you move forward. When you have a failure, learn from it and try to make sure you don't have that same failure again. Where you have successes, how do you build on those successes moving forward, and understand that some of the things that you have and plan for may not happen, and that you're going to have a bunch of new experiences along the way and cherish each one.
You've been listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we have been talking with Beth Killeran from HHS. I want to thank you for sharing your incredible journey and advice with us. I'm Gigi Shum.
I'm Aileen Black.
Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum, founders of Accelerated Government Strategies. Learn more about AGS and the work they do to help accelerate your business plans for public sector at excelgovstrat.com. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Women of Washington, Wednesday afternoons at 1 on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.